Yeah.
It's all yours.
Thank you very much, Paul. Well, good evening. And it's nice to see so many old friends and lots of new ones as well. So tonight's talk is called Kalyanamitta, Spiritual Friendship. I'd like to begin with a quotation from the Pali Canon, which is the collection of books in which the Buddha's teaching is set out. And the quotation illustrates the meaning and power of the term Kalyanamitta. That is the central part that good friendship plays in pursuing the Buddha's path. This quote is from what is known as the Sutta Pitaka, that section of the canon which records the talks of the Buddha delivered to lay people and the order of monks and nuns, as recalled by his cousin and lifelong attendant, Ananda. So to quote, as he was sitting there, Venerable Ananda said to the Blessed One, "This is half the holy life, Lord. Admirable friendship, admirable companionship, admirable camaraderie." "Don't say that, Ananda. Don't say that. Admirable friendship, admirable companionship, admirable camaraderie is actually the whole of the holy life. When meditators have admirable people as friends, companions, and colleagues, they can be expected to develop and pursue the Noble Eightfold Path. Ananda, it is owing to my being a Kalyanamitta, a good friend, that beings subject to birth are freed from birth." So this short extract contains some deep and profound wisdom that I'd like to elucidate and expand upon in my talk this evening. The Buddha's not exaggerating in the slightest when he tells Ananda that spiritual friendship, and in particular one's relationship with a Kalyanamitta, a qualified spiritual teacher, is the whole of the spiritual life. As I shall explain, the relationship one develops with a meditation teacher is of inestimable importance and value. It's more important than the relationship you have or have had with your parents or guardians. It's more important than the relationship you have with a spouse or partner. It's more important than the relationship you have with your children, and more important than the relationship you have with your closest worldly friends and associates. Why is this? Well, none of your worldly relationships and associations will provide the key to the highest possible form of wisdom it's possible to aspire to. No one other than a skilled and qualified meditation teacher will be able to help you unlock the secrets of life and reveal to you the very purpose of human existence. Only the Kalyanamitta has the power to help you attain liberation from all forms of suffering. Spiritual friendship, in a wider sense, is also of great importance on one's spiritual journey. At the Orkana Trust, we have an extremely strong Sangha, a spiritual community whose reliability and stability offer perfect support for those intent on finding an end to suffering. That community, moreover, is founded on spiritual friendship, spending time with those of a like-minded nature who do their best to keep the five precepts, revere Buddha Dhamma, the teachings of the Buddha, and their meditation teacher is immensely valuable in strengthening one's own confidence and inspiring one to follow the Eightfold Path to the best of one's ability. The Sangha is populated by people who are basically heading in the right direction and who possess characteristics that the Buddha himself praised. As he put it, one should seek spiritual companions who find opportunities to help you, who offer friendship through thick and thin, whether you're happy or sad in their company, who offer sound and compassionate counsel and who empathize with both your joys and sorrows. Speaking personally, having been a member of the Orkana community for nearly 40 years, I can honestly say that I've taken great comfort in belonging to the Sangha. During that time, I've made deep and lifelong friendships with individuals who exhibit the very qualities that the Buddha commended some 2.5 millennia ago. So, what are the benefits that derive from being an active member of a meditative community? The Buddha answered this question as follows, to quote, "When meditators have admirable people as friends, companions, and colleagues, it is to be expected that they will get to hear at will, easily, and without difficulty, talk that is truly conducive to developing awareness and insight. That is, talk on modesty, on being content with little, on the value of meditation, on non-attachment, on sustaining effort, on virtue, on concentration, on meditative investigation, on liberation from suffering, and on the knowledge and vision of liberation from suffering." So one derives great strength from being part of a wider group. Even though you may not know everyone intimately, there's a sense of togetherness that acts as a source of solace and uplift, particularly when the going gets a little tough, as it inevitably does from time to time. Indeed, meditating formally on the recollection of the Sangha can be an excellent way of uplifting the mind when it appears to be flat or you're experiencing anxiety, for example. It can be an extremely effective way of counteracting hindrances such as doubt, ill will, and worry, and is a practice I personally used extensively in my training. One begins by reflecting on the noble qualities of one's teacher and friendships at this centre, which often invokes feelings of metta, loving kindness. And then one extends these thoughts to the vast worldwide population of people who are currently striving to follow the Buddha's path. One can then broaden the reflection further to take in the countless numbers who followed the teaching in the 2,500 years since the Buddha first set out the Dhamma. It can be greatly uplifting to think about the many thousands of followers who've realized the fruits of meditation. This group of people is known as the Sāvaka Sangha and Arya Sāvaka. That is, those people who've realized full enlightenment or reached significant stages on the path. So one can use one's membership of the Sangha in a very practical way to bolster one's own meditative practice. So far, I've talked in general terms about the importance and benefits of a friendship that derive from being a member of a Sangha, a community of people who are dedicated to the Dhamma and intent on following the Eightfold Path. It's critically important to recognize, however, that what lies at the heart of a vibrant and healthy community is the quality of the teaching on offer. This is where the Kalyanamitta comes to the fore. And we're greatly fortunate here at the Orkana Trust to have a spiritual head in the guise of Paul, who is fully versed in and qualified to teach Buddha Dhamma. This cannot be emphasized enough and is a matter of utmost importance. The Buddha declared himself to be the Kalyanamitta par excellence. In other words, as is perhaps intuitively obvious, the best instruction possible is that from an historic Buddha. The slight problem is, of course, that Gautama Buddha died some 2,500 years ago. So much as it might be desirable, this is a possibility not open to us. However, all is not lost. Many thousands of people completed their training under the Buddha's instruction during his lifetime, and his exceptional organizational skills meant that, through the orders of monks and nuns he established, the teaching passed down from generation to generation. It spread globally and is still very much a living tradition. We here at the House of Inner Tranquility are direct beneficiaries of that marvelous inheritance. Recognizing and anticipating that not everyone would have the benefit of being taught by him directly, the Buddha set out a hierarchy indicating in rank order who was best qualified to teach, and therefore who one should seek out as one's Kalyanamitta. Next in line to the Buddha would be one of his enlightened disciples. Again, not a possibility for us. then it would be someone fully conversant with the Dhamma, who had completed the training and who had themselves realized enlightenment. Failing being able to access an enlightened teacher, the next in line in descending order would be meditation teachers who've attained one or more of the paths, that is so-called non-returners, once-returners and stream-winners. These represent individuals who've reached the respective stages of fruition by following training in Vipassana meditation of the sort we teach here. If such teachers are unavailable, the Buddha then suggests one seek instruction from someone who, at the very least, has accurate book learning and can guide one in the right general direction. Plainly, however, the latter is far less desirable than receiving direct instruction from a meditation teacher who possesses experiential knowledge of the Eightfold Path, the various pitfalls one is likely to encounter, and how to navigate it successfully. We're exceptionally blessed at the House of Inner Tranquility because there is a tradition here of the community being led by teachers who fully realize the truth taught by the Buddha Gautama, that is, who've realized enlightenment and attained complete release from suffering. That tradition continues to this day, and we're deeply fortunate to have someone leading the center who's not only realized the fruits of the paths, but has acquired the skills to teach others how to progress and fulfill their spiritual ambition. I should also add that there have been very many meditators over the years who, under such consummately skilled instruction, have successfully completed one or more of the paths of Vipassana, and several who've completed the training entirely. We should be aware, however, that by no means everyone who makes progress or completes the training will become Dhamma teachers. Quite the opposite, in fact. Most will not. So it's quite a legacy we have here at the Orkana Trust. Everyone here has the immensely good fortune to be expertly instructed in mindfulness meditation. This is a rare opportunity that should not be squandered. In my experience, the teaching here is unique, and I've been lucky enough to travel the globe as part of my job, and that's included very many working trips to Southeast Asia. In all my travels, I haven't come across any meditation groups, monastic or otherwise, that make the Dhamma available and offer instruction of the quality available here. This is not to say that competent Dhamma teaching is not available in other groups and communities. I'm sure it is, but my point is that fully qualified teachers are not to a penny and are, on the contrary, extremely difficult to find. So I've come across some people who think that we're being rather boastful here at the Orkana Trust in openly declaring our teaching credentials, and who think that it would be somehow more polite or discreet were we to refrain from letting the wider world know about the quality of our teaching. Well, it certainly is not boastful, indiscreet, or inappropriate in any way to make clear what's on offer. In doing some research for this talk, for example, I came across an interesting section of the Visuddhimagga. It's a book called that translates as The Path of Purification, a text that's widely acknowledged to be one of the most important and definitive commentaries on the Buddha's teaching. The section I found raises this very question in relation to identifying a qualified meditation teacher, and to quote from the Visuddhimagga, "But how then does someone with kankas destroyed, that is, an enlightened person, declare himself thus? I am one with kankas destroyed." The answer that given is terse and uncompromising. The answer, why not? He declares himself when he knows his instructions will be carried out. So in other words, if an enlightened person is disposed to teach and knows that they can assist others in making meditative progress, it's perfectly appropriate for them to reveal their status to others. How else would a prospective student know they found a suitably qualified teacher. Making this open declaration establishes a teacher's credentials and authority, thus giving others the confidence to take instruction from them. So the Visuddhimagga makes abundantly plain that it can be appropriate for the Kalyanamitta to declare their meditative achievements when circumstances suit, and when it will be of advantage to the community that he or she serves. This is why we speak openly at the Okana Trust of the credentials of our head teachers, past and present. So having come across a Kalyanamitta with the necessary credentials, what do they offer and how should you relate to them? When speaking of the Kalyanamitta, the Visuddhimagga, that book I mentioned, The Path of Purification, says that he or she is a noble friend, a senior lay meditator of the Sangha, or a monk or nun, who serves as a mentor to their pupils, wishing for their welfare and concerned with their progress, acting with compassion to guide their meditation. Good friends possess the following qualities. Again, I'm quoting the Visuddhimagga. They are revered and dearly loved. They speak and listen to the speech of others. The speech they utter is profound. They do not urge without reason. So when one comes across a Kalyanamitta with such qualities, they should be treated with great respect. And what does this mean in practice? Well, it's customary, for example, to bring a gift to one's teacher when granted a meditation interview. Try to give thought when choosing the gift to what the teacher might need or be pleased to receive. You might bring a traditional gift such as flowers or incense, but equally, according to your means, you could bring a gift of money, a delicacy that you know the teacher enjoys, an artifact that you think they would like, or a card with some thoughtful words of gratitude. However, it's not so much the monetary value or potential utility of a gift that's important. It's having the right mental attitude of genuine giving that counts. As the saying goes, it's the thought that counts. Before attending a meeting with the Kalyanamitta, one should ensure that one's personal hygiene has been attended to. That is, one has washed or showered, cleaned one's teeth, and dressed in clean clothes. Such preparation is a practical way of showing consideration to the teacher and ensuring that one does not give offence with one's appearance or demeanour. It's polite to knock on the teacher's door at the agreed time and wait until invited into the room. One should approach the teacher with head and body lowered and then offer one's gift to the teacher with both hands. This act of gift-giving opens up a channel of communication between you and the Kalyanamitta and indicates that you are seeking and openly ready to take instruction. All of these acts of consideration set the appropriate tone for the meditation interview. Incidentally, if you're having a series of interviews on a meditation retreat, you need only bring one gift to offer at the first interview. I seem to recall instances where people thought they had to give a gift each time they came to an interview, and that's not the case. So during an interview, one of the most important qualities to demonstrate is openness and honesty. If the teacher asks a question about your practice, try to be as truthful as you can in answering. Always try to give a warts and all answer rather than trying to dress things up in an attempt to impress the teacher or make yourself look good or to mask what you know is going on in your practice. If you're experiencing various hindrances or distractions, which every meditator does, then tell the teacher about it. Excuse me, I'm going to have to cough. I've got a chest infection I can't get rid of. So, if you're experiencing various hindrances or distractions, which every meditator does, then tell the teacher about it. And remember that the teacher will see right through any intention to impress, to exaggerate, or hide things. What they will be most interested to hear is factual and accurate accounts of your meditative experience. It's this unadulterated information that will enable them to assess what's going on and give guidance that will help you progress. The greatest gift that you can give a teacher is to put into practice the individually tailored instruction and guidance they provide. Such guidance is precious and needs always to be taken to heart. The only way of moving forward with your practice is to follow the Kalyanamitta's instruction with determination, commitment, and devotion. Incidentally, following instruction to the best of one's ability is also the only way of establishing for oneself whether or not a Kalyanamitta is authentic, or equally, whether they are the right teacher for you. When you first meet your teacher, it's best to commit to practicing what you're instructed to do for, say, the first 6 weeks initially, and then assess for yourself whether you're moving forward, whether suffering is lessening. Is the practice working for you? If so, then give it another 2 to 3 months. Sorry, 2 to 3 to 6 months, let's say, by which time perhaps you will have completed your first silent retreat. At that point, you should make another reassessment. If it's working, you'll gradually develop increasing confidence and be able to take and follow further instruction in the knowledge that it's working. If, having given it your best shot, you don't perceive any benefits from practice, then it's wise politely to inform the teacher and seek instruction elsewhere from another teacher or group. The Buddha described his Dhamma as ahipasako in Pali, which means come and see for yourself. If, having tried to put meditation instruction into practice, you find that it's working for you, all well and good. If not, then it's best to move on. Excuse me, this cold. Terrible. So the Kalyanamitta, that person always has your best meditative interests at heart. They've generously, and I might add at considerable personal sacrifice, agreed to show others the way to discover the Buddha's truth. To that end, all the instruction you receive will be offered from an established base of compassion. But what does compassionate teaching look like? How does it manifest? Well, one thing is for sure. It doesn't mean that the teacher will invariably be all sweetness and light. In actual fact, they act as a kind of mirror to your mind and will reflect directly back whatever you bring to them in the moment. And what you bring to a meditation interview, believe it or not, is not invariably going to be sweetness and light. That would be impossible for someone still in training. Let me share with you a personal anecdote to illustrate my point. The following episode happened right here in this space, long before the present shrine room was created, and when it formed part of the centre's founders, Jackie and Alan James's, personal quarters. Excuse me. This space here was a kind of living room come dining room with a kitchenette. It was full of exotic tropical plants, all of them beautiful species. And over here, round about where Anna is, there was an armchair, a low coffee table, and a couch. So I was sitting opposite one of my teachers, Jackie James. She was over there, and I was in the couch. This was during a retreat. It was a meditation interview in the early days of my training, probably a year or so into my training. Shortly after entering the room and sitting down, I noticed that Jackie had a rather dark expression on her face, which I must say was rather unsettling. She then said, "Peter, it's like you've just come into the room and emptied a bucket of shit all over my head." Well, to say that I was shocked by her uncompromising words would be an underestimate. She'd never said anything quite as graphic or direct to me before, and I was wondering what's happened to the joyful, friendly teacher that I'd come to love and admire. Well, to be honest, I don't recall much else of that particular interview. It was a long time ago, but as you might imagine, what she said stuck with me and made me reflect very seriously on the encounter. What had happened? Well, I now know that I must have been running a good deal of ill will at that time when I went into the interview. It was probably rooted in frustration and disappointment with my practice, and that would have been brought about by over-effort and wrong concentration. In her compassion, and it was a compassionate act, Jackie simply threw the facts back at me. Why were her words so direct? It was because, firstly, having got to know me and my practice, she knew that I was ready to face up to what was going on in my own mind. Secondly, she knew that I'd developed sufficient confidence in the Dhamma and her as my Kalyanamitta that I'd be able to cope with the shock and the directness. Yes, it would be unsettling, but it wouldn't dissuade me from carrying on as a student. When a teacher appears to get cross or angry with you, and incidentally, there are very, very many examples in the Buddha suttas of the Buddha being very direct and uncompromising with students. It's actually a mark of their confidence in you as a student. The experience I've just shared stayed with me for the rest of my meditative career and inspired me, like nothing could, to become more mindful of states of mind, which is one of the four foundations of mindfulness, particularly the state of mind that was present when I attended a meditation interview. It's not that I never again went to a meditation interview running ill will or some other form of hindrance. It would be a long time before that would be possible. But I would be aware of my mental state and be honest with the teacher about it. Whenever I was sufficiently aware, I'd also practice metta or a recollection before an interview so that I didn't pollute the space and the teacher with my own self-generated unpleasantness. Shifting the mind in a positive direction also had the added benefit of making me more open to the wisdom the teacher had to share. My main point is that the Kalyanamitta's compassion expresses itself as needed in any given moment and as dictated by the supporting conditions. So it's not always going to be pleasant from the student's point of view. Indeed, the teacher's words may well give rise to unpleasant mental feeling, but those words will be appropriate to your stage of development. They will be sensitive to your meditative needs and your longer-term welfare. To recognize this, however, requires the student to have sufficient faith and confidence to face up to what the teacher is saying with even-mindedness. One has to learn to roll with the punches, so to speak. The Buddha once said that if you find a suitable Kalyanamitta, you should stay with them, even if they beat you off with a stick. If the teacher discerns that you're ready for it, it can sometimes feel that you're being beaten off with a stick. Jackie and Alan's teacher, the Venerable Kapiluwaro Bhikkhu, once told them that if his teacher had instructed him to walk to the edge of a cliff and jump to his certain death, he would have had no hesitation in doing so. I can honestly say that I would have done the same thing if instructed by one of my teachers. Such was the confidence in the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha they inspired. for me, my teachers became the very embodiment of the Buddha, his teachings, and the community. By resolutely following the instruction of the Kalyanamitta with devotion and dedication, any meditation student is afforded the opportunity, eventually, to walk to an edge of a cliff and jump off, metaphorically speaking. To their great surprise, when they do take that leap, they will discover that what awaits them is not death, far from it. Instead, it's a leap that will take them deeply into the ultimate mystery of life. It's a leap into the infinite, the eternal. When one is drawn to leap, moreover, all existential questions evaporate completely, and in their place there arises a profound and irrevocable realization of that which is always already the case. Well, thank you.